Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
You're listening to the Sherlock's Podcast, your guide to a more stylish life. Hello and welcome to the Sherlock's Podcast. I'm Georgie Corrigan, Sherlock's founder and CEO. Today we have a special edition. It's the Parenting Podcast, and we're here to tackle some of the big challenges faced by parents of tweens and teenagers today, from social media to peer pressure to puberty, you name it, we're going to cover it. And to help me answer some of the big questions on these topics, I'm joined by Dr. Shardy, Head of Family Therapy at the Soak Clinic, and GP and founder of the Face Bible, Dr. Raj, and Georgina Blasky, our home and interiors editor, and also a bit of a sage, an oracle when it comes to all things parenting. Thank you, Georgina. I always wheel you out in anything parenting related. Your children are now
14 and 17.
Oh my God, 17. I didn't even say that.
Yeah. 17. Yeah. Gosh. Just had a driving lesson.
Wow. Wow. Gosh. Well, you know it all. And Dr. Shardy, can we talk with you? Welcome. Can you tell us a little bit about you and your experience when it comes to the tween and teen space?
Right. So I'm a systemic therapist, a family therapist, but I specialise, well, my special interest is teenagers, actually, and younger adults. So anything from 12 years up to whatever age they still believe that they're young.
Don't be all. I still feel 27. And you work at the Soak Clinic.
I'm head of child and family services at the Soak Clinic.
If you don't know it, it's, you know, highly esteemed. Can you tell us a bit more about
So we're a private mental health clinic, and we have the child and family service, where we have lots and lots of highly qualified practitioners, such as psychiatrists, right, adolescent psychiatrists. We have clinical psychologists who specialize in different things, ADHD, neurodiversity. We have eating disorders specialists. We have OCD specialists, like specialists in every attachment difficulties, in every kind of area.
Anything you need help with.
And then there's an adult clinic as well, yeah, with the same specialties.
Well, you have a great, great reputation. I've known of you for a long time. So thank you so much for joining us. Welcome, Dr. Raj.
Hi,
thank you for having me. Tell us a little bit about you.
So I'm Dr. Raj Arora. I'm a GP in the NHS. I also am a private GP, and I'm founder of my private clinic, which is the Face Bible. So there we see lots of different patients, from, you know, babies all the way up to obviously adults. So I also see quite a few teenagers and young adults as well. And then we also do things like integrative wellness, skincare, aesthetics. And we work really closely with the spa, which is at the Fairmont Windsor Park, which is where I'm based. And we work to do things that are going to bring wellness to families and wellness to, you know, individuals. So we kind of work quite closely with them as well. So, yeah.
Well, thank you, ladies. It is a critical stage. Do you remember that film with Kevin Costner where he gets into a box and they wake him up 20 years later? Mm. I always wish I could put my tweens. I have a 12, 11 and 6-year-olds. And I long to put my 11 and 12-year-olds into a box and wake them up when they're 21, hopefully with their mental health intact. It really is a critical, critical stage. It's a stage I'm sort of quite anxious about, in all honesty. There's huge physical change, emotional change going on during this time. Georgina, 15, 17, you're in the thick of it. Maybe you're through the worst.
I don't know.
Georgina, let's start with you. What suggestions do you have? How have you supported yours through these years?
Well, I think what's been tricky for us is we hit it when COVID arrived. So that meant that we were spending a disproportionate amount of time with teenagers to what we should have been doing. They should have been out with their friends more, going to shopping centres and cinemas and having sleepovers and parties and going to their first party and having their first kiss and drink and all those things. And none of that happened. Mm. Obviously more for my daughter. My son was only about 11 or 12 when we had COVID. So I feel like it was a really weird time, because her experience of entering teen years wasn't the regular experience. So we've then got to a point where we're kind of catching up. So there's been a bit of an acceleration I feel like I've just sort of strapped myself in and gone along on the roller coaster of it. But what I would say, my overriding feeling is teenagers get a really bad rap. And I think teenagers are so delightful and interesting and have kind of woken me up to so many aspects of the world. I feel like the sort of the curiosity they bring, the pushback they give. I know people say, oh, I've learned so much when I became a mother. And I feel I'm learning more being mother to a teenager than
really?
To a baby.
Yeah,
they're just really interesting. I love the chat. I think they're sort of original thought. So I just think that that's my main feeling at the moment.
Might change. We'll see what happens when they're 21.
Yeah.
That's exactly why I love working with teenagers. So challenging. I mean, every session is amazing. There's a real discussion and they challenge me and I can challenge them, and I just find it fascinating every session. They're great.
I mean, I agree, the curiosity. I love nothing more than sitting down and saying, right, let's learn about something together. And whether it's, we were Googling the International Space Station the other day on holiday. We're like, oh, I know so little about this. Let's learn about it together. And we were all asking questions. And that was really fun. That's the fun bit, I agree.
Yeah.
The pushback, I find a bit harder. How do you support that? It's quite emotional, isn't it? There's quite a lot of slamming doors and rolling eyes and stamping feet. And that's very different, I think, from when they're sort of... I've got a six-year-old. She's happy all the time. It's pretty straightforward. I feel like it's up and down and up and down. How do you support them through those?
Well, I mean, that's when they're building character, isn't it? And when they're separating from, like, if it's a girl, she's separating from you as her mother. So it's a very healthy thing to have that pushback, because if she adores you and thinks that you're God's gift on earth, she's never going to separate and become her own person. And I see quite a few mothers and daughters, that's another specialty I have, where, the daughter is, they have a very symbiotic relationship, and the daughter's like in her 20s and wants to live at home and wants to go to university in London because I need to be close to mummy. And, that's not very healthy.
No.
So when mums say to me, my daughter is just impossible, always like, challenging me and the pushback, and I go, great. It's fine. It's part of the growing up. It's part of the process. She is building her own character. She's building her own personality. She's becoming someone independent. Of course, there need to be boundaries. So you can't allow her to just do and say whatever she feels like saying. But within boundaries, it's great that she's doing it.
And I think what Dr. Shadi said is so true, because I often see, families come in, dads, mums with their teenagers, often daughters. Around that time, your hormones are changing anyway. So you're going to be having these pushbacks, and sometimes you're not quite in control. You might be premenstrual, so your particular time of the month you're more pushing back more, or you're arguing more, and parents come and say, what's wrong with her? And I think really trying to cement that's a very normal developmental stage firstly is important, and then I think reminding them that they went through that too. Like, if we look back at when we were teenagers, we probably went through a pushback stage and also didn't need our parents or felt we didn't need them as much. And then you get through that. I mean, I'm like 35 now, and with a little toddler, and now I need mum again. So now I'm calling her and she's like, oh, you're back. I'm like, mum, I've had a really rough day. And she's like,
you've had your gap year. Yeah. I'm back in now. So decade.
That's it. You have your gap. You bring up your character. You become the person you're supposed to become. And then those relationships are still there. But like Shadi said, it has to be there for you to grow, develop. And it's really normal, I think.
Mm. I remember growing up looking at other people with their mothers, and they sort of told them everything. And I was just like, oh my God, they're telling their mother all about who they kissed or more. And that was not the relationship I had with my mother. And I always sort of thought, oh God, I'd love to be that open with my mother. And I remember then looking at my brother not that long ago and saying, she's actually brought up quite independent children. So perhaps I haven't done her enough credit for doing a really good job. And not that those other children haven't been brought up really well, but I suppose I then sort of realised she'd done what was appropriate and what I hope to do for my children. And as you say, I think it does change when you become a parent yourself. I think you appreciate your parents on a whole new level, but I think it's not until you become a parent yourself. How do you get that balance now right? What advice do you have so that you don't overdo it? I think boundaries are so important. I want to be close. I want my children to be open. I always listen to you, Georgina, with, real respect for the relationship you seem to have with your children and a level of openness. I remember you talking about pornography once. Do you remember this?
Yeah.
And you said we were reading the papers on a Sunday and there was something in the papers and you thought, right, I'm just going to rip the plaster off and we're going to have this conversation right now. So you were like, well... we need to talk about something. And then you said your children asked you something about your own sex life, and you were like, no, no, that's private, that's mine. I'll talk to you about the theory.
Yeah, we can or talk anything about sex, else. But we're not talking about my sex life. Yeah, we're about sex. And it's I not just the same.
And I don't know. I really admired. I've never forgotten that conversation.
Nor have I.
It's out there. I'm really sorry. Yeah. Just brought it up again.
Yeah.
How do you? What advice do you have?
I'm afraid a lot of mums these days, onto teenagers, they often say to me, I can't be asked, I can't be bothered. And that's the one thing you shouldn't say as a mum, because you can't be a mum and then just not be bothered. You have to be bothered all the time. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
and or they say, oh, if I do that, she will be so angry. And I go, and? They're almost afraid of the reaction of their daughter or their son. And I kind of think there's nothing to be afraid of. They'll be angry. You'll manage the anger. And it's because they don't have that close relationship. So, of course, then what they want to do is just discipline and forbid and say no. And you can't say no if you don't have a relationship. It's the same with the dog. I'm sorry to compare, but, you know, you can't say no to a dog and discipline a dog if you don't have a relationship with the dog and feed the dog and give it, you know.
Yes.
It's the same with children on a higher level. You have to build the relationship from childhood. You have to have these open conversations without forbidding. You know, you have to say to them, this is what porn is about. You know, this is what happens when you watch porn on TV or on whatever it is. Let's talk about it. Let's talk about what's the dangers of that, so that they know that they can tell you everything. I have two adult daughters now, but they would actually tell me everything, you know. And sometimes,
and did you encourage that?
Oh yeah, because I never said, oh my god, when they told me something. All right, let's talk about it. You know, those kind of exaggerated, you know, oh my god, and how do you know, how is this going to affect me? A lot of teenage girls say to me, it's always about my mum. Like, I tell her something and she's like, oh, this reflects so badly on me, or this has such an effect on me. And then that just shuts them down because the mother is not there for them. So I think it's really important to build that relationship from a young, you know, even if you haven't built it before, it's never too late. You can start building that relationship. And a lot of my sessions with mothers and daughters is about that, helping the mum to rebuild their relationship. And it works because the child has it in their DNA to want to be close to their mother.
But it's hard to get the boundaries right, isn't it? I mean, you know, there was a level I didn't go to because it just was not accepted. And I, you know, I had my moments of being a bit naughty, but I knew not to push it too far. And I knew that if I pushed it too far, that would be it. And I'd come in and my toothbrush would be out and I'd creep up. I knew that if I woke my mother up or I came in and was sick in the middle of the night, or, you know, that would just be it. And I respected that and I pushed it to the end, but I didn't push it over. I had been brought up to respect her and respect those boundaries, but equally we're in a world where we do want to be close and we do want them to open up. Are there any sort of strategies? I mean, people always say, you know, lying next to them on the bed at bedtime and not looking at them in eye to eye and getting in the car, and, you know, we've heard lots of those. Are there any sort of tactics or strategies for parents of tweens and teens that you would advise for, you know, if you feel like you aren't quite as close as you'd like to be?
What I always say to patients and when they come and talk about this is that, you know, you can start at any stage, like Shadi said, but obviously if you've got, say, a toddler, so I've got a 3.5-year-old, and it's really exhausting doing this because obviously 3.5-year-olds are very curious, but I try, like 99% of the time, even if I'm exhausted, to listen to him. So he might be having a rant this morning. He was asking me something about putting a car in my boot or something, and I was talking to somebody else. He said, Mummy, you're not listening to me. You know, and I was like, I stopped and said, I'm really sorry, mummy didn't have a listening ears on. And as exhausting it is, you're late, you're running late, you know, you take a minute to say, what is it that you want to say? You listen. And I think that in itself is building a sort of like a safe space for the child to begin to feel that they can talk to you about anything, how they're feeling. We always have a chat before bedtime about good choices and bad choices. So I'll say, what good choices did you make today? And he'll tell me, and what bad choices did you make? And do you think this was the right thing to do?
That's nice. I can see myself having that conversation with a 12-year-old.
But there's still a boundary. So if he's pushing it too far and he's asking, can I have chocolate for dinner? You know, he's going to get told off. And that, no, we're not having chocolate. But I'll explain why. So because it's going to do this, and you can have it after, and maybe we'll have that chat. So I think it's the same concept, I think, you know, all the way through. And my mum, there's me and there's two sisters and we have a brother. But my mum was so close to us girls because she would come to our room. And I didn't appreciate that till now. So every evening, she had four children. She used to work. She'd come and sit on each of our beds for 5 minutes. And she'd just ask us, like, how was your day? What did you do today? And something that was really, like, probably meant nothing to her. So I'd be moaning about my, you know, I was, what, 13? Oh, this happened today. And Leah did this. And she'd really take an interest. Oh, my gosh, yeah. Did that happen? You know, blah, blah, blah. And I think that opens the doorway for you to feel as a tween, teenager, you know, early adult, to have those conversations.
Georgina, what tactics have you used, you continue to use? Share them, I'm all ears.
It's really interesting because I was talking about childhood. My mother's Danish, so I had quite, I would say she took quite a kind of hands-off approach, a sort of typical Scandinavian, let them get on with it, sort of make mistakes and everything. And I think growing up in a time where we weren't monitored in the same way, was helpful. And I now feel like she never checked my homework. She didn't, you know, there weren't that many rules.
Oh, no, nor did mine.
It was all very hands off and probably quite sort of typical of 80s parenting, which I think was quite.
By the way, I still don't check my children's homework. I mean,
no. So I did the never same. Have. Yeah. So, and I kind of feel like I always just want them to be safe. I want to know, I'll always want to know where they are. You know, physically, if they're going to someone's house, that's where I expect them to be. If they're not there, all hell will break loose. Yeah. But the trust is that they will be there. I do have things like a Life 360 app so we can see where they are at any time, and they can see where we are, which is kind of equally important if they're out. It also will show me where they've been. So it's not that I use it to catch them out. It's just useful that if their phones died, I'll know where they last were.
Yeah.
So there are some elements of technology that's actually really helpful, and it's open. They know that we're tracking them, and part of the rule of being out late is that that is never disabled for their safety. We live in London, we need to know where they are. For me, I just think it's really important to respect what they want to keep to themselves, as long as it's not doing them any harm.
Yeah.
I think that having a level of privacy is really important for them.
But them feeling if it's worrying them that they can. Yeah,
but 100%, they know the door's always open. They just need to know that there is a listening ear without judgment as well. I try and listen. It's really hard. It feels like when you're sitting on your hands, but
I know with my daughter, I can sense. And I can't do the tell me. Yeah. That does not work. That is like the shut has come down. She's quite hard to get things out of in that way. And I'm like, do you want to chat about something? And I have to just gently play. My stepmom was always very good. She used to pick up my little brother from school and she'd be like, "Brad, they told me what happened." And he'd go, "Oh, Mum, I didn't mean to." And she had no idea anything had happened. She just had a sense that he probably got into trouble that week.
That's so funny.
She'd say, "Oh, well, you know, if you don't eat the carrots, don't worry, just you know, leave them there. You don't have anything else." And suddenly the carrots would go. And, you know, she was just quite clever at not going into you hard and fast, because that would make them recoil. And I've always sort of remembered that as a tactic. What about with boys? I mean, we've talked about girls. I mean, they're a different species, aren't they?
I think with boys as well, you need to build that relationship. I think the thing is, if you forbid things, they're going to do it behind your back, which is the worst thing they can do, isn't it? So you need to make sure they don't feel that you're going to freak out when they tell you something. They will experiment. They'll be much more, you know, they're curious. They want to experiment. They want to take risks. Not the girls don't, but boys do probably a bit more. And it's okay, but you need to talk about it. So I had a close friend of mine who had four boys. And they were quite wild, I have to say, quite, you know. And she would say to me, "Oh, you know, I've told them they're not allowed to be out. They can't go to any parties." And I said, "That's the last thing you need to do. You need to say to them, go to these parties. There's a risk that you're going to have, you know, lots of people who are drugged out around you and blah, 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 blah. If it gets too much, send me a text message. I'll call you. Pretend that," I used to do this with my girls as well, "pretend that I'm the one insisting you come home for some reason, family emergency. You can roll your eyes and say, 'Oh, my mom,' and then you leave." And that's what they did. And it was great because they did use that. You know, once she said that to them and said, "It's okay, go out, experiment, do whatever you want. But if you feel uncomfortable and you have that tingly feeling in your tummy that something's not right, let me know." And they did. I mean, she didn't believe it. She said, "I never thought that they'd do it." But, you know, teenagers want to have boundaries. I'm sure your children love to know.
And they might not want to be seen to lose from. Yes. That doesn't mean they don't want to get
exactly
out of
it. And I've heard that strategy before. And I remember actually when my daughter first started finally going to the sort of the teenage party scene and just saying exactly that. Just blame it on me. Just I'm the excuse. I'll be the bad. It doesn't bother me at all.
We had that. I said, "You can say your mum." She said, "Oh, everyone else has got Snapchat." And I was like, "You can say your mum's a real pain." Yeah. But she works in social media and it's just, she's not, you're not having it. Just blame it on me, Sam. And she seemed really content with that.
Yeah, they do. But they like boundaries, you see. Children like boundaries. Children like to know that the parents are in control. A child who has too much power, a teenager who has too much power, boy or girl, feels very insecure and scared because they're not supposed to have the power. So, you know, I remember one boy, we had a session with the boy and his parents, and I was telling the father, you know, in nice, firm terms, that he should be a bit more firm. And the boy, 16, he looked at his dad and he goes, "Do you get it now? Be a fucking father. Do you get it?" And he was shocked. He was like, wow. And afterwards he said, "Can I see you on my own?" And he came and he said, "What happened there? Like, why? When did I stop being a dad?" And we spoke about it. And he said, "You know, at one point I got really frightened of him. I got frightened of his reactions. And the more frightened I was, the more aggressive he became. Because, you know, they want some kind of boundary. Yeah. Stop me now."
I think I mentioned it on another podcast with you. We had a behavioural expert come and spend some time with us. Anyway, I have a son with ADHD and various other neurodiversity challenges. Although, don't we all, frankly? I mean, yes. It's a spectrum.
It is.
And we had somebody in and it was really about... you know, readdressing the boundaries, and just the transformation was so instant. I mean, and yeah, it's so simple, but it changed so much so quickly. It was really, really very interesting. Georgina, you've got a son.
Yeah.
Different strategies with him?
Yeah, different. So he's got ADHD and he's 14, and it is a different strategy. I feel I have to be kind of firmer with shorter instructions and very clear, which I then think sometimes can come across as being quite forceful. But I think he and I are very, very close, and therefore the respect is there enough that it works, because he knows it's got a massive force field of love behind it.
Yeah.
So I think that's okay. And
my son would be sitting here next to me right now if it was up to him. So if I'm going to give, I have to be... not aggressive, but very assertive. So it's really clear.
So he's at a boarding school now, and they get up to a bit of mischief. Obviously, it's lights out, but they're all kind of sneaking around, playing little tricks on each other. Lots of kind of pranks, you know, sort of pranks with water bombs and like proper pranks. All quite innocent and fun, but obviously it's going to get you in trouble. And you've had the odd phone call, you know, maybe he'd like to calm down a bit on that front. Nothing major. But it did open up the conversation of whatever happens, we need to like talk to us, tell us about it. You know, we're all on the same team, so we're going to work together to sort of deal with it. Never be afraid to call, because my biggest fear is that he won't call. He'll be eaten up with anxiety and fear and stress, and that will lead down a much darker road than. Yeah. So
we're on the same team, and I can't help you if I don't know the facts.
Yeah, and it's I'm not gonna endorse your behaviour. But I think we've got to work together to work out how to address it and move forward.
I'm your mother.
And
I'm
still will
you.
Punish you.
I'm stuck with you.
Yeah.
You might be in serious
and also
trouble,
you're stuck with me. So, you know, you might lose your phone and you might lose your gaming or whatever. Like, there will be, don't think there won't be a consequence, but let's at least try and tackle it together, because that's what my biggest fear is, them just disappearing off to their bedroom and just going to a very, very dark place. Yeah. And then you kind of lose them.
And that with boys, I think is the worst.
Very.
For me, with my son, it's like the thing I worry about the most is depression in teenage boys. And
because the statistics
that.
As well, for especially with...
they're much more introvert.
ADHD, there's a higher risk of depression, suicide, anxiety, everything. And it's a really scary thing to read.
I'm short of breath just hearing those words. I mean, that is what runs through my head in the middle of the night. Yeah. There is a teenage boy with...
And it runs into their adulthood, you know, with boys. And I think... for boys, that is the fear. They're going to go, they're going to recluse and go away. And I think sometimes having repercussions with boys, and actually that's the conversation you're having. So you're still on their team, but you're saying, come on now, you know, that wasn't right or whatever. And you're setting those boundaries, and they can't set those for themselves, especially if they have neurodiversity challenges or ADHD or whatever it might be. They're going to find it, they're anyway wild, aren't they? Boys generally are off doing all sorts, and then they're going to be pushing those boundaries even more. So I think actually having that conversation, saying, look, your phone's going to go, or you can't game, or whatever it might be, might just keep them in check a little bit more.
And like, there is that, shouting. Like, there is
shouting
and door slamming. And
but
I'm
will be
to you for the rest of the day
them,
not from me. That goes on.
I'm happy, Sarah. I'm not talking to you for the rest of the day.
I need a timeout.
But like Shadi said, they want that, you know, but they're not going to be as vocal as, say, a girl might be about that, generally.
But I have to say, I also feel that, you know, boys especially need a dad, like a proper dad. you know, who would do things with them, do activities with them, go out, talk, have discussions, set boundaries. And a lot of fathers are absent. They're absent because they're working too much. And then when they're not working, they're too exhausted. So they have to go out and meet friends or be on their phones a lot. And, you know, a lot of mums say to me, my husband's not around. So a lot of the times I have to really encourage the dads to be a dad. And once they start being a dad, it's magical.
I also think being a dad is, and I've got a son who's very different to my brothers, who were very alpha and sporty. And my son is a different child, interested in different things. And there's a sort of stereotype of a father, isn't there, of, you know, going to watch football matches or whatever it is. But it's also like the softer side that a father can bring. And actually, my husband is great at that. I mean, particularly with my girls, and he will chat and chat to them and in a different way than my father did with me. Not to criticise my father, he was brilliant in lots of ways. But I didn't have that relationship with him. I didn't have that relationship that I can open up with a man and feel that safety of a father, which I think is different to a mother. And boys need that too, don't they? I think it's a really important. I was reading the book Raising Boys the other day, and it was, you know, encouraging this softer side for boys and that being okay and having emotions and talking about them. And I think doing that with the fathers,
so important.
You know, I do that with my son, but it's really important that he does it with my husband
father
too.
To do that. And, yeah. And if your son is, you know, upset, or, you know, to have the open space to say it's okay to cry or it's okay to be upset, you know. And I think with my little boy, obviously he's still a toddler, but we have that conversation with him. So when he's crying about something that is, he's allowed to cry about, maybe he's bumped his head, whatever, we're very mindful not to say, oh, come on, you're a boy, don't cry, you know. It's okay, you can cry, let me know when you're feeling a bit better, and having that open conversation. I think for boys, yes, there's that whole thing about football matches or let's go to cricket together or let's golf, but actually, you know, just sitting down and painting a picture or just sitting down and having a chat, you know, if your child's a bit older.
Going to the pub and packing a crisp.
That's it.
And then having a really wise girlfriend with four children. That she's like you, Georgina. She's just, every time I see her, I'm like, just let me inhale all the information I can. I'm like, can I do TikTok? And she's like, yep, you can go now. You can go now. So Coco's like, have you seen Coral? Am I allowed it? I'm like, yep. She says you can have but she, I always remember her saying, little moments, yeah, one-on-one. It doesn't
little
need to
moments,
be a whole
exactly.
Football. We touched on sort of the emotional side of things. Can we talk about bullying, cyberbullying, how we protect them, how we tackle that with them? I mean, I'm sure you see people in your clinics, young people in your clinics, who were there with massive anxiety and damage over that. What advice do you give?
I think the first thing is to recognise it and talk about it. So actually, I've seen quite a few, especially my NHS clinics post-COVID. So, you know, parents coming in or a teenager coming in and talking about how social media has given them anxiety or isolated them because of different things, things like imposter syndrome or feeling that they're being attacked online. And obviously, when you're online, you're going to say things that you probably would not say face to face in the real world, you know. So you're going to have people attacking you, keyboard warriors, talking about how you look, commenting on weight. And in clinic, you often see patient, you know, teenagers coming in with their parents, whatnot, who have been isolated or who are feeling anxious post social media. So I think it's important to firstly recognize the signs of it. And I always talk about how the family can help them. So, you know, if you're becoming more recluse, if you're going into your room, you're more down, your appetite's off, you're not eating, you're bothered about your weight, how your image is. These are all signs of where has this come from, you know, because it often is social media that's triggering that. It might be a TikTok video they've seen. It might be somebody attacking them on Snapchat. There's all sorts of groups and things that go on online. So I think, yeah, it's important to recognise it, start thinking about how we can have an open conversation as family, and then also how to take time away from that social media source so that you're not being overwhelmed. Because I think youngsters, especially teenagers, feel the need. It's almost like a social for them. They have to be online. They have to get onto Snapchat at a certain time or go onto TikTok and have this conversation or follow a certain video, whatever it might be, and everyone's commenting on it. So I think it's that trend, trying to give them the information and giving them the space to have an informed choice. You don't have to be a part of that. And how can we slowly come away from it? But yeah, these are some of the more negative sides, I think, of social media that we see often.
And following on that, we're also talking about bullying as well. What advice do you have from children who do feel victimised? I think it's important as well to stress that the definition of bullying is repeated. It's the repetition of that. I think that word is bandied around quite a lot. I just thought it's really important that children know that. I know that some amount of, sorry, being teased and picked on is really normal. You know, I sort of say to my daughter when she's upset about something, and I'm like, I wish I could make this go away, but it won't. And you know, maybe, you know, I still feel like you do about friendship sometimes. I'm afraid it's sort of human nature. And
well, the teasing is normal. Bullying is on another level, I think. I'm a trauma specialist as well. And in trauma, we say that being bullied is probably the worst trauma ever. And often when I say this to parents and the children who've been bullied, they're very shocked and they're like, why? And I say, well, because if you're being, for instance, in a war zone, you know that the people throwing the bombs are the bad guys. If you're being tortured, you know the torturer is the bad guy. So you still blame yourself a little bit. That's the whole thing with trauma. But when you're being bullied, you're often being bullied by so-called friends. Because, you know, unless it's one bully who bullies everyone in the school, you're not affected. But it's usually best friends or close friends who then start ostracizing you, saying nasty things. They just and so in order for your brain to make sense of that, the brain goes, oh, it's not them, it's you. You're the weird one. And unfortunately, a lot of parents actually ask their children as well when they say so-and-so has been mean to, well, what did you do? So that enforces the belief that something's wrong with them. And so it is a real trauma. And I think that schools need to be aware of that as well and kind of, you know, try and understand what's going on for this child and try and help the child to feel confident again and get out of that so-called friendship group and find another friendship group where they're actually nice to them. But yeah, the cyberbullying is something that is, because then it's 24/7.
Yeah, so then going on to cyberbullying, which is what you were talking about, Dr. Roche. Yeah, cyberbullying. I mean, how do you tackle that? You're hoping they share it with you, I suppose.
That's the only way to tackle it, is really have that relationship with your child where they know that they can come and tell you so-and-so saying this about me. This is what they're putting in this group chat about me. This is what they're saying on Snapchat. They've posted this on about me, so that they come and share that with you and you can tackle it together. And you can first of all say that it's not their fault. Then you can go and talk to the school about it. I mean, there are lots of ways to tackle it. And our CEO this morning told me about this app which has been developed called Erica with a K.
Yeah, I've heard of that.
And
yeah,
it's a very good app where it encourages young teenagers and young children to kind of go on the app, and you decide, like, I want to be off social media for like 2 hours a day. And the screen is basically black, so you don't have access to it. And for every hour that you're off, you get points. And they've done a partnership with View Cinema, so that if you get, I don't know.
Nice.
You this amount of points, you earn points, and you can get free popcorn, and you get, and that's really good. And if you could just, you know, tell your children about that, and the parents can do it with the children, say, let's go for an hour a day and see how that goes. Let's go for 2 hours a day. But, you know, the worst thing about social media is children see their parents be on their phones 24/7.
I know, yeah. I know. It's tricky that.
Directly impacting them.
Directly impacting. The
difference is, I'm often working on my phone, so to be present with them. I mean, yesterday afternoon, I took them off for the afternoon school holidays, but I'm juggling two roles at work and being their mother. And actually, the only way I could take yesterday afternoon, I mean, it wasn't off, was on being on my email at the same time. So it is difficult, because it's kind of do as I say, not as I do. But I'm not sitting there just on Instagram all afternoon. I'm actually responding to emails and looking at documents. And so it's quite hard, that, isn't it? Because you don't look like the best role model, but you are actually using it for different purposes.
But I think also explaining that, so just saying that I'm actually on emails, and if I wasn't for work, I'd love to be out doing this or that, you know. And I think there's all the research, there's a study done October 2021, I think, Shadi, you might know about this one, all about social media and teenagers and young adults, and it actually showed that you know, there are lots of positives of social media and technology for teenagers, but also, you know, doing something organic and something in the real world, you know, shows a boost in mental health for youngsters. So if you're giving them an alternative, whether it's music, dance classes, somewhere to shake off their energy, not Snapchat or TikTok, you know, they're going to gain much more from it. So apps like Erica, I think we're going to see a lot more, you know, in this tech space in the next decade or so, are going to offset that, the option. So basically, you don't have to be on social media. What else can I do? And what's my incentive for that? Because you're getting an immediate hit of endorphin when you get onto social media. Immediate. We know that, you know, from research. So of course, for a teenager who's got all these emotions flying around and hormones, that's where they're going to go. It's like, you know, it's almost like a drug for them. It's like a happy place until it becomes an unhappy place. It's an addiction. So where else do you take them or show them that you can do something else? I think what you've said about taking the kids off and doing other things, and dad spending time in the pub with, you know, having a pint and having a laugh, or a game of snooker, going for a music lesson, swimming, whatever, dance class, whatever it might be, horse riding. These are all other things that are going to put you out outside, away from social media, collecting your points on Vue, and then you're going to go to cinema and go and see your, you know, with your friends. And it just changes that narrative. And I think that's where, as a GP, as, you know, as a family practitioner, when I see families, I'm like, you need to find another way. You know, even if you're on the phone all day, I mean, my job is social media a lot, because I do a lot of health content creation, YouTube, TikTok, Instagram. So I have to create content. But I'm really mindful, even around my toddler, that, you know, when I'm home with him for those 4 hours before bed and everything, that my phone's not there, because he will say to me, "Mama, can you put your phone away?" Or, you know, last week he was like, "Mummy, can I put your phone in the bin?" And when he said that to me, I was like, okay, you know, he's obviously telling me something. So I put it away.
Yeah, I mean, that's the difficulty. The little ones, you are physically modelling.
Yeah.
I feel like when they're, you know, my elder two, I'm now able to say, look, if you want me to come on holiday with you for how many weeks this summer, I'm going to have to be part-time working, so I will be on my phone. That's the, like, that's the trade-off. Otherwise, I can take 2 weeks off and I got to be in the office the rest of the time. So, you know, I guess it's difficult, because when they're little, you are more physically modelling. Yours are teenagers, 15 and 17. Yeah. I guess it's just like you're in a different place now. But how have you approached social media? How have you protected them? Mine have screen time. Do you still? So do you wait for them to sort of take over?
I think this is the bit which I've probably got the most wrong. Because of COVID, because that was the only connection they had with their friends. Mm. And they both had their own phones. And it was actually, to me, a lifeline for them. I mean, my son was on Fortnite talking to three or four friends through the whole of COVID, having basically virtual play dates. So it was an absolute dream. The issue was breaking that habit when we all, you know, emerged from our homes. And, you know, we have had... obviously, I'm not going to go into details, but we've had some really unfortunate cyberbullying instances in our family. And I think it's been the most challenging, and I think it has had the biggest impact. And I'm absolutely fascinated that you just said about it's the biggest trauma that a child can go through. And that kind of just felt like a sort of wrecking ball moment to think, God, really? Because I, you know, you would think divorce, death, all these kind of major things, wars. But actually, that is... I still think there are repercussions and impact from things that have happened years ago, unless you cut them off completely. I don't know if there is. I don't think there is a way you can 100% protect them, can you?
Protect them, no.
Help them deal with and process, maybe.
That you can. There's trauma treatments called EMDR, which I do a lot of. And
what is that?
That is basically trauma treatment. It's a treatment that we do for trauma, and it helps the brain to digest the trauma they've been through. Then they get rid of this bad belief about themselves and they gain in self.
How would you like to look 5 years younger? In a clinical study, people that had volume added with Juvederm Voluma XC in the cheeks perceived themselves as looking 5 years younger at 6 months after treatment. Look younger, feel like you. Add volume for lift and contour in the cheeks with Juvederm Voluma XC. Reverse signs of aging by adding volume to smooth laugh lines with Juvederm Volure XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Confidence, and, you know, but it can only happen if they're no longer in that environment. So if they're still in the same school where they were bullied, you can't do it.
I mean, they're such formative years, though, aren't they? And that's sort of where we started. And I certainly have moments at school where, you know, I had, like we all do, many insecurities or character traits in myself I was aware that didn't necessarily endear me to others as much as more positive traits might. And other children, friends reacted to those, not necessarily in positive ways, you know, whether that was being bossy or, you know, whatever. But I still think back to those moments and those feelings at school and being a teenager, and it's still like, and when I see my children now upset about friendships or, you know, a group's not being kind to them at a party or they weren't invited to that party. I mean, one of the most horrible things I've witnessed is my child not being invited to a party and everyone at the party sending them messages on social. I mean, that was brutal to watch, a massive group of them and my child wasn't invited. And I'm like, oh, I feel like she'll remember that for the rest of her life.
It's so triggering,
and it's normal. And I'm like, it's really normal not to be invited. Yeah. And I remember finding out I wasn't invited to something and it hurts. But I guess you then put social into the mix and you're like, it's like a dagger.
I think what's harder though is if something happens to your child, whatever age they are actually, but the teenage years are particularly painful, I think. And it triggers something in you, but you then don't want to react and project that on to them, but it's such a highly emotional moment that you're not necessarily thinking in that way. And I think often the way that, you know, if I can see one of my children hurting, the way that I react probably is coming from some place of trauma that I've experienced, because I definitely wasn't invited to all the parties. No, and
I've been picking up my six-year-old, so this was way before, from school once, and she said, it's Bella's party. And I was like, and I went to someone and I was like, oh my God, have I got this wrong? And she said, oh, there's seven of them going. And they were sort of her friends. And I got home and I just went into my bathroom and I cried and cried. And I rang my husband. He's like, what's happened? What's happened? And I was like, she's not been invited to Bella's party. He's like, all right, Anne, I think we're okay. But, you know, it's
heartbreaking.
It's really heartbreaking. It's really hard to watch. And
you
can't do anything.
You know, you probably feel quite powerless in that moment.
But then you put, you know, and then fast forward and they're 12 and it's happening and you're putting social media in the mix. It's amplified. Social media restrictions, screen time, monitoring. I'm looking at you, Georgina.
Yeah, this is not my area of expertise. I mean, hands up, I honestly, it's not great in our house that the kids come, I'll call them for dinner, and I can hear TikTok coming down the stairs. Like, you are able to leave your bedroom and enter the kitchen without your phone in your hand, and like they're going to the toilet. You could leave the phone in the kitchen while you go to the loo before we have dinner. You know, it goes everywhere with them.
Yeah.
And I don't use my phone like that. I don't walk around the house on my phone. I use my phone. I say, you know, I'm going to check Instagram for half an hour now. I do it and then I put it down. And I do something else. And I just think that balance is hard. And I definitely feel that's an area that I have not put enough time and energy to. And then you read about the people at Apple who don't let their kids have iPads until they're 16 and all that stuff. And you think, oh my God,
because they know the harm
it does. They know the dopamine hit and the, you know, I say to my kids, like, you know, that game has been developed by a gamer and a psychologist together so that they can make it highly addictive.
Absolutely.
It's not just a coder sitting somewhere. It's, you know, it's all done to keep you on it.
I think it's so much harder when they get to, you know, like 16, 17, 18, because they're not going to really be privy to you minimising their screen time. I think when they're a bit younger, 11, 12, 13, if they are on their phones, I've got nieces and nephews, and they basically have like locks on the phone, so you can have screen time for so long and then it's done, you know. And if you want to have long, you have to request for a code or
we have that now. And my husband introduced that when we were away at Christmas, and oh my God,
how's that going for you?
it was hell. And he obviously introduces these things and then off he goes, and then
you're left to deal with it.
He's gone. Not that I'm a stay-at-home mother. I mean, freaking hats off to stay-at-home mothers, my God. But I don't quite get to just walk out of the door like he does. And anyway, it was not a very easy time, let me tell you. But actually, he was like, I know this is right. And as much as I was like, you started this and now you get to walk off, I did know he was right, and he was right. For a few weeks, it was Otto wants more screen time, Coco wants, you know, in constant requests. And then we were like, if we're on a car journey or, you know, we're travelling, we will consider giving you more screen time. Other than that, it's also really useful. This is probably against the rules of, as a threat to take away when they don't behave. It's quite effective, actually. But it has been good, and they have slightly learned to self-regulate a bit. And sometimes we'll get to sort of 2 o'clock and Otto will be like, I've still got an hour and a half of screen time left, and Coco's run out. And it's like, bad luck. So it is good. And then there are certain apps you can restrict. You're nodding.
I think it's really important to have screen time.
And what sort of limits? Is there a limit?
Well, it depends on the age, right. And it also depends on the child. So some children aren't very addictive and they don't get addicted to it and they get quite bored. So for those, you don't really need to restrict. Some become very kind of addicted to it and you do need to restrict, but by explaining, not just saying, right, that's it. You need to explain why. And I think one of the important things is to make sure that the children don't have access to any of that from 8 o'clock onwards, because, and they need to have their phones downstairs and not in their rooms, because, you know, it does affect their sleep. And when it affects your sleep, it affects your mental health.
Yeah, 100%. And I think that's even for adults, isn't it?
But for adults as well.
All the studies show that, you know, blue lights need to be away. So when parents come in saying, oh, you know, I go past her or his room and it's a light, I'm like, but that shouldn't even be a thing, you know, like blue light away 1 hour, 2 hours before bedtime, at least by 8 p.m. And then that kind of frees you up for the evening to have those conversations around dinner, you know,
exactly.
To have time as a family, whatever's happened the day has happened. And then you're going to be calming all those emotions down before bed. Everyone's letting out how they feel and you're ready for bed and you're kind of getting into a sleep routine, a sleep pattern. The children you see and the teenagers you see that have poor sleep and then poor mental health is a side effect of that are the ones that are probably up because they'd have no regulation till 2 a.m. blue light screen on their, you know, and they're tapping away and watching things, and which I think is unhealthy. Social media, 100%, I think it's needed. It's there. It's here to stay. It's going to be the future. But I think regulation of that, because we know the impacts on mental health are so important. So yeah, like you said, screen time is important and restricting. It is so important too.
Georgie, you know, what time do your children's phones...
I'm asleep.
You used to be really good.
I did.
I mean, they don't bloody go to bed. This is the problem now. Yeah. I mean,
I did hear a nice story actually the other day about what seems to be a new phenomenon amongst some teens, which I would be fully on board with for mine, is that when they go to a party, have a big tray or bowl, all the phones go
love
in there.
It. Oh, I love that.
So they just have a really fun party. No one's messaging someone who's left out. No one's taking
That's
photos
so
of someone who's drunk too much and embarrassing them.
What a
in our youth
idea.
When we could do what we wanted because it wasn't being recorded. Yeah. You know, they actually just disengage and then they're in the room together. Yeah. So they're actually in the moment rather than, you know, I've seen groups of teens hanging out, whether it's in Nando's or in someone's living room, and they're all together on their phones.
Yeah.
And I think that's really quite depressing.
Well, I actually have my daughter's 12th birthday here at the office. They did a scavenger hunt. They lost points if they got their phones out. There were two team leaders. And if their phones came out of their pockets or their bags, they were docked points.
That's amazing.
Anyway, they then came back here and had a bit of fun in our studio. But anyway, we were, no phones are allowed out. And yeah, they had a great time, far better. So yeah, I think that's a great shout. Can we talk about peer pressure? And I mean, it sort of leads on nicely from social media, because I was quite strict about TikTok and Snapchat. I resisted for quite a long time, but she kept saying to me, all my friends have got them and all my friends have got them. What do you do when children are telling you that other friends are getting things, other friends, do you just stand true and, you know, stick to your morals?
When you know your child, you know whether you can give them access to it or not, or how early or how late you can give them access. I mean, TikTok and Snapchat are less, I'd say, dangerous than Instagram. Instagram, I think you really can't go until you're well into your teenage years and where you can actually make your own decisions and not be so
influenced. What's a guide for Instagram? What do you say, roughly?
When you feel that your child is really mature, has a head over their shoulders and isn't going to go, oh God, I need to do that because so-and-so is saying it, you know, and not as influential as, and for some it's 13, for some it's 17, for some it's 20. You know, of course, you can't do anything when the child is 16 and they want to have Instagram, they have to have it. But then you have to have conversations, because some are very influential and they get very influenced by all these social influences and, you know, about the eating and the dieting and the body image and all of that. And some aren't. They just think, well, actually, I'm very happy the way I am. So it depends on the child.
Things like Love Island, that whole interplay between how they look and even treatments they're having are really apparent on Instagram. They might talk about them or they're not trying to sell stuff on there because that's their job. And I think for a teenager, if you haven't got a mature head on your shoulders, that can be very influential and actually detrimental to them. Because I've had, before the law came through of obviously minimum age of 18 for aesthetics and injectables, I would have 16, 17 year olds coming in saying, I want to look like this person or, you know, whatever. And we practice a very ethical aesthetics clinic. I spent a lot of time doing lots of psychological screening for them and saying no, no, no. And the answer was no. You know, every time, basically, because why at 16 do you need to really have lip, unless you've got beyond psychological issues with your appearance, which are vetted and you may have to have treatment for that. You don't really need to change your appearance. And every time it was because of a filter or something that they've seen on Instagram or showing me a picture from Instagram, you know.
how do we encourage them to make positive choices and not, you know,
following that
ones?
Yeah, I think it's really hard, but I think again, like Shadi said, you have to have those open conversations. Yeah,
it's having honest conversations with your children non-stop, all the time, you know, in the car, when you're walking, and, you know, not conversations about them particularly, but you know, I often say to parents, you know, talk about, oh, I just heard on blah, 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 that so-and-so thinks this is really bad. You know, the Kardashians was really big when my kids were growing up, and they were obsessed with the Kardashians, and I just thought, what a waste of time. But then I thought, well, if I keep saying what a waste of time, they're going to get more obsessed about it. So I used to start watching it with them, and I actually thought, this is great, they're eating. All these women are eating. They're eating pasta, they're eating bread, they're eating rice. It's great.
And they've got a real sense of family.
Yeah, a real sense of family.
Series, I think, are excellent. I mean, they've built the most brilliant media platform to launch all these businesses. It's really admirable. Yeah.
And I used to say to them, this is great, this is great. However, not so sure about this. So you can influence your child. You know, if you know what they're up to, you can influence
them. The quiet
nudge.
Or if you're watching the Kardashians and you're having a conversation, it's like, oh my god, Kim's done that, what do you think about that? And you know, you're having an open conversation. I don't like her hair, like, well, she's done this to her face, or she's definitely had butt implants. You're having this conversation, and then you kind of get
planting the seed.
They're gonna say, oh mummy, I think this was great, or the boy, your son,
my
might say,
was a very
she looks
seed
hot
planter.
You know,
see,
yeah.
I tried to leave university, and everyone went bonkers in my family, and she said, come and chat to me. And she said, yeah, I mean, I get it. I mean, I was hungry to start work, and I'd secretly gone off and interviewed at Foxton's to be an estate agent in the days where you got a BMW. I told my family, they went mental. And she was like, come and chat to me. And she was like, yeah, I mean, I get it. She said, the only thing is, you've got to pack up. She said, you could just go up and finish the last term of the first. You can say goodbye to everyone, pack your things up, and then, you know, you start in a few months. I was like, yeah, that's a good idea. And off I went. That was the end of it. So,
clever.
Planting the seed, quietly put the carrots out, and slowly they disappear.
But, you know, all of this takes time and energy. And that's what I want to say to all parents is, like, invest in your children. Invest in them because, you know, plant these seeds.
Can we talk about body image, self-esteem? You touched on diet, Kardashians, eating. Gosh, I mean, I spent a lot of my teenage years counting calories. God, if I could tell my younger self to get a grip. But, you know, the chances are, I mean, there aren't many women who don't have some kind of body hang-up. It's pretty normal, isn't it? How do you keep it on the right side of normal? I also really believe there's nothing wrong with wanting to look good and your best, and that's different for everybody. And for Kardashians, it's having a big juicy ass. For someone else, it might not be. You know, that might be their biggest hang-up. We're all different, right? What advice do you have?
Well, I think, yes, all women have had that. But with Instagram, you know, I think it's gotten 50 times worse. Yeah. Because all these, you know, and it's funny because I work with a lot of, you know, top models and influencers and everything, and they all hate their bodies. I mean, they all look gorgeous, but when they come into the therapy room, what they talk about is how much they hate their bodies and they can't stand it, and they wish they could eat a little bit more and they can't, you know. So they all have problems, but of course online, when you look at them, you think, wow,
yeah,
they're so happy, they're great, they know exactly what they're doing, you know, all these kind of like diet experts who give expert advice, they all have, the ones I work with, all have some kind of eating disorder. You know, that doesn't come across on Instagram.
Online,
does,
yeah.
It doesn't.
Well, whenever I take a picture, I'll take 30 pictures and then I'll crop them. I always say to my daughter, I'm like, look how many it took me to post one. So just remember.
Just remember, just
And it's just, again, that planting that seed and, you know.
Planting the seed. So you need to talk to them about all of that, you know, and about, like, diets and what's healthy and what isn't healthy and, you know, how you need to enjoy life is what I want to say. Enjoy life.
It's difficult though, because, you know, I've got a 12-year-old who wants to eat sweets all day. Really, really wants to eat sweets all day. And that's bad for her skin. It's bad for her teeth. You know, the orthodontist, she's got train tracks. The orthodontist said, look, I can see in your gums that you're eating too much sugar. And I'm sort of trying to not do the whole, it'll make you put on weight, it's excess energy. But I'm also trying to make them understand in a gentle way, you know, energy in, energy out. You've got to move your body in. That's better for your mental health, not only your physical health, not only your skin, not only your... It's hard, that message, isn't it? Because I think movement and being inactive is so much more than how your body looks. It impacts so much of our life. So it's hard to get that across without worrying that they'll get hung up on their body size.
I think taking an approach which doesn't necessarily talk about the appearance, maybe, and talking more about the health aspect of it. So, you know, excess sugar can lead to things like diabetes and poor heart health in the future. And of course, you're young right now and you're beautiful and everything's wonderful, but there'll come a point where maybe this will impact you in a way that, you know, you won't be able to do things that you want to do with your life or be as active or be as healthy. So I think that angle always works better because you're not focusing on their appearance, which is hard because in this day and age, everything is led by appearance, you know. Mm. And I think...
I do believe that your appearance has an impact on how you feel about yourself. I feel like really nervous to say that on a podcast, but
you know, no, it does. It does.
You know, when you've got a spot and your jeans feel too tight and you're pale and pasty and you haven't, you know, you don't feel your best self.
And I think owning that is important. So saying, like, you know, it might give you breakout or you know, your teeth might get rotten or whatever it might be. Is important, but I think, you know, not always shifting the weight on appearance also, and trying to talk about other aspects of what that might do.
Georgina, you've got a 17-year-old daughter.
Yeah, my first thought is they're savvier than you think. So I feel like my daughter is pretty clued up. What she loves about, say, TikTok is it's so unedited. It's so raw. Yeah. It's so that person walking along with their kind of, the hair's got stuck to the lip gloss, or maybe like the mascara's running or something's just off. And she loves that. And Instagram is more curated and presenting. But then she also follows accounts of people, influencers, all shapes and sizes. And I think that when I was growing up, it was magazine covers with kind of Cindy Crawford. And I feel like it was more damaging in a way where we had... every photo was retouched,
edited.
And I feel now, yes, there are filters, but they all know. I mean, she knew when she was 14 that she wasn't looking at a real image.
Yeah.
And I feel that actually...
Yeah, 90s skinny Kate Moss. Gaunt.
Yeah.
I mean, we didn't know. Jodie Kidd was like, that's my teenage years. I mean, we grew up watching Jodie Kidd walk down the runway. And that was
heroin chic.
Yeah.
And then I remember hearing Kate Winslet talking about, you know, I've been so airbrushed on this magazine cover, I don't even have a nose. I've got two, like, holes. But the bridge of her nose had basically been retouched so much it wasn't even there. It was, she said, you know, they've taken me in here, and she really called it out. So I feel that my life with magazines was worse. And I think that I completely agree with everything you're saying about Instagram, but I do think there is also so many cool people out there who are more alternative. There's more diversity in body shapes and sizes, and whether you're getting into the kind of LGBTQ and all these other sides of expression. I feel like the kids will call me out on being, say, more judgmental about somebody because of almost my upbringing and the era that I grew up in, and kind of everything was like, these are the boxes that everyone needs to fit in. Whereas I feel that that is less
boxy,
so now.
Less boxy. Yeah, definitely.
But I think the peer pressure on kind of what to look, what to wear, where to shop, you know, I mean, with my son, it's all about trainers. It's those sorts of things are still there.
Yeah, I mean, they're pretty brand savvy, aren't they?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Can we talk about substance abuse? Georgina, I'm looking at you.
I wasn't glue sniffing.
15, 17. I used to love the smell of petrol when I was when I used to charge. You remember the days? Books. Highlighters and petrol. can we talk about, I mean, vaping massively on the rise? I mean, I think we're not in that world yet. We're not in the drinking certain, you know, or anything else stage yet with our, you know, 12 is my eldest, you've got 15, 17.
Yeah.
God, that terrifies me. I sort of see them sitting on the common. And how do you approach that again? Is it conversations again, communication? Cross your fingers and hope for the best. I mean,
it is conversations. I know my younger daughter had lots of friends who did lots of drugs, not my older daughter for some reason. She was never really interested by it because she was freaked out to see their reactions. But we would talk about it. She'd come home from a party and she'd be like, oh, my God, and they did MDMA and her jaw was going like this. And I'd talk about it and I'd say, oh, my God, so tell me a bit more about this and that. It's about conversations and talking about, you know, what are the implications, you know, what happens when you do that, and how you can lose control. But also know that, you know, teenagers will try things and it's okay. if they tried. It's absolutely fine if they tell you about it and you don't make a big deal.
Do you say that? Do you say to them, I know you're going to try it, so...
No, not that I know you're going to try it, because they may not.
Yeah.
But if you feel like trying it, let me know. My brother was always very curious, and this is way back, and whenever he saw someone doing something that was not good, he wanted to do it. So I grew up with a brother who wanted to do everything, try everything. You know, he did, and then he didn't like it, and we moved on.
But I still remember at school being in chapel, and we all had to gather in chapel, and this big screen was wheeled in, and we were played the video about Leah Betts. She took an ecstasy tablet at a party on her 16th birthday.
Yeah, she died.
And died, and I think it was the first and only time. And it terrified us enough to never take an ecstasy pill. And do you think fear is a good way to go? I mean, should we expose them to that? I mean, it genuinely worked. We start to booze and fags. And, yeah, I'm not saying that's great either, but, you know,
I think it's really important to talk about those things, actually, and say, I've heard about someone who, you know, of course, with my work, I can make up stories as well and say, you know, I've got a client who did this and he had a psychosis and he was freaked out afterwards and blah, blah, blah. But I do say that to my clients, and I say, and these true stories, some made up, mostly true, when you talk about things that have happened to other people. So you're not necessarily saying this will happen to you.
Yeah, you're not lecturing them.
You're just saying, oh, I remember someone who did this, and oh, gosh, yeah, and that happened. Oh, and then they get interested. Yeah. And it does put them off. Yeah. Absolutely.
As a GP, we do that all the time. So you're just telling them, you know, this is the health risk. And I don't say don't, you know, if a teenager comes in 16, 17, head on shoulders, is quite, you know, has autonomy. I'm like, you know, you can do ecstasy if you want to, or MDMA, whatever you want to do, but cocaine. But just letting you know there's a, you know, high risk of this happening, and people die. I've had lots of patients who've died from it or have done excess. Not to say that alcohol won't kill you in excess as well, but obviously, you know, a glass of alcohol is not going to be as harmful as, say, a dodgy ecstasy pill. You know, if you want to take that risk and not be here tomorrow, then that's... And normally that's enough, I think, for a sensible child to say, I think I'll stick to a drink of alcohol and, you know, do that, or I'll go for a vape, you know. And obviously vaping is on the rise, so that's...
Well, yeah, where do you stand on vaping?
When you're in thinking about it as a doctor, so as a GP, it's a step down. Okay, so vaping's introduced as an e-cigarette so that you have less risk. Remember, traditional smoking can cause up to 10, 15 cancers. So you're trying to bring people away from the traditional smoking, reducing their risk with vaping. It's a step down. That's not to say there's no other risks associated with vaping. We just don't know fully what those risks are. There's definitely toxic chemicals involved, all these different flavours they're having. There's nicotine, so you're still addicted. But actually, it is a step-down measure. So
It is.
So what I say to patients and, you know, teenagers who come in, I say, look, why are you vaping? Because if you're going to get addicted because there's nicotine in there, but also you're probably putting yourself at, you know, the studies to show risk of heart and lung conditions in the future. So it's not as safe as it's made out to be. It's not as environmentally friendly. You know, disposable vapes are plastic and inflammable and all those kind of things. So if, you know, and now it's quite trendy to be like, you know, want to be all about the environment. A lot of youngsters think about that. So that's another angle you can use and say, actually, it's not.
And someone said to me that the danger is that one vape is sort of 600 cigarettes. And the trouble is, with a cigarette, you smoke one to the end. Is the danger that you vape so much?
All day. You vape all the time.
All day. Just sitting there vaping away. You know, you're vaping indoors, you're vaping outdoors and all these things. And I think...
So one vape is the equivalent of how many, or is it not like that?
It depends, because what's hard to quantify, I think there's actually talk about a legal ban in the UK from the councils on by 2024 for vaping.
Banning it entirely?
Yeah, there's a talk. It hasn't happened yet, but they're talking about it.
Because banning from a certain age?
No, they were saying to ban disposable
vapes. What age
do
you have to be to buy a vape?
I think you have to be like 16. Vape, yeah.
But that's assuming the shop is enforcing...
That.
Oh, for sure.
There's
for
lots
sure.
of laxity, I would say. And there definitely are 12, 13-year-olds who are vaping. And, you know, some of my patients are doing that. And parents have brought them in. Doctor, can you talk to her? Or they might come in themselves and ask. So I think there's lots of health repercussions, because we don't know, really, what toxic chemicals are in the flavours, how they're being, you know, created. What's happening is that idea is being misused by teenagers, and they're all going out there now and vaping all these different flavours. And it's becoming trendy and cool, and they're vaping all day. And I guess in the next decade, we're going to see a lot of fallout from that.
Yeah, it's interesting, the vape conversation, because what has struck me from the kind of little research that I have done is the different standards around producing the vape itself. And I had a conversation with a friend recently, and she's got a just turned 15-year-old. And she said, I know she's going to go to parties and they're all vaping. I've seen them all vaping out and about. So I know they're all vaping. I'm going to buy my daughter the what I think is the best, least toxic, least harmful, not made in, you know, in China somewhere, but maybe actually has some kind of CE mark on it even, or just something. So I know that what she, and so then I've told her, you must only smoke your own vape. Don't share vapes. Don't vape off someone else's vape, because that might be the most toxic vape out there, because there are different levels. Is that right?
That's correct. Yeah. So it's not being monitored. There are companies that are, you know, official vaping companies who are producing the vapes. Obviously, a lot more expensive. Lots of teenagers can't afford that. Yeah, so they're going for the cheaper.
There's the candy flavour. The candy things, flavour. Like you're saying, which are full of the chemicals.
That's it. Disposable vapes. One-use plastic, with they're inflammable. So even to dispose of them is costing the government millions, billions of pounds. So lots of issues around vapes. And I agree. If you're talking, like we said before, about alcohol versus ecstasy versus vape, you know, I'm not going to say don't vape. It's going to be really bad for you. But I think those choices you're making about which kind of vape, where you're purchasing the vape from, what's in the vape liquid.
You think that's good advice?
I think it's important to know what's going on. If a child's buying a vape, what are they buying it? Where are they buying it from? And what's inside that the juice that they're putting in, you know, the actual fluid.
And is there a brand that you know of that's better than others?
Honestly, no, because I think what we do is, as doctors, is we give them step downs. We'll say, you know, if you're going to go and vape, this is where you should go to a vetted vaping centre to do that. Or, you know, we'll be telling them where to go. You can often go to one and find out. But I think when you're looking at teenagers, they're not going to like a... they're not going to an e-cigarette place to get it. They're buying it, a watermelon something, or getting it from a friend. Yeah.
Georgina, just on the subject of ecstasy tablets versus alcohol, cigarettes, vapes.
Yeah.
When, how much, any advice you've got on yeah, substance
I mean, all my daughter went to Reading Festival last bank holiday, as in last summer, kind of GCSE rite of passage. That was quite a terrifying prospect from the drugs point of view, because I knew that she hadn't been in environments where there had been drug taking. And I know I can say that thinking I knew. I genuinely really don't believe, because I know her circle of friends.
Yeah.
Whereas this was something that was going to be completely, you know, rite of passage moment, unmonitored. I was actually more worried about things like spiking.
Mm. Oh, this just fills me with absolute terror.
Well, the spiking in the drink, but you
can't. Kevin Costner box to put them
in. Well, I think we did a bit of kind of role play. If you are in a situation where everyone in the tent is doing this, what might you say? Or if you do want to try it, you know, there are some things you can try where, obviously, if you're smoking a joint, you're having a couple of puffs. But if you take a pill, that whole pill is in your system and you can't get it out. So you might
want to
think.
And you don't know what's in it.
And you don't know what's in it.
That's the fear.
Yeah, and it's sort of, I don't know, it's hard. I don't know what the right answer is. I don't know if there is
that
really.
That is the right answer. No, it's a good answer. Talk to them about the dangers. Talk to them about it.
But I've also had the conversation, because I think there tend to be more boys who might...
Yeah.
Be interested, as particularly around smoking, weed and things like that. And if that sort of comes in with the sort of the ADHD side of it. And actually, I do know a couple of people who later in life, sort of 20 years later, have had psychosis.
Yeah.
And I've read about celebrities talking about it.
Having
smoked
weed
heavily, say, from about 15 to 25, that classic kind of teenage years, heavy, heavy smoking, and then stopped, and then created a life, and then sort of 10 years later it sort
Absolutely.
Of comes back.
Psychosis,
is that right?
Schizophrenia.
Yeah. And when I've told my son that story anecdotally of two friends of friends that I know, he has been
horrified,
absolutely horrified.
I mean, those kind of conversations are much more efficient than saying don't do it, it's dangerous, blah, blah, blah. It just goes over their heads.
Yeah. We need a little book. We need a little book with all these stories we can read at bedtime. Bedtime story, darling. We're going to do the one about psychosis
today.
Can we talk a bit about the LGBTQ community, how we encourage, you know, inclusivity, support, you know, whether it's our own children or their families? What would
I mean,
you
I
say
think that's something that's great with this generation is they have a lot of acceptance.
Yeah, it's
they just take it in their stride, whatever, and I love that. And
totally
and parents should just go with it.
Yeah,
really, it's as simple as that. They don't question it; they accept it. You know, I've got a client who was a she. Then he said he wanted to be a he. Then he said I want to be a they. Now they've gone back to saying I'm a she, and all within 2 years.
Mm. And I think as a parent, you have to just
go with
the less. Curve. Yeah, and I know a similar she to he and back to she, and you know, all is well. I'm not saying it's well because she is a she again, but I'm saying, you know, you just have to roll with it. You know, I think of my stepmother, you know, don't rise, just
but
come and chat
with
to
it,
me about
roll
it.
Roll with it is different to encouraging it.
I totally agree with you.
You know, that's very different. So I was working
because that's confusing for a child. I think when they've got so much flying around. Yeah,
exactly. Exactly. And that's why, you know, some of the clinics like the Tavistock Clinic NHS, they've closed now because they just said this is getting out of hand.
My
We've got 9-year-olds coming in and the parents are saying give them hormones. So I think there's one thing to accept it. There's another thing to forcefully
absolutely.
Encourage something.
Absolutely.
And I think it's, physiologically, you know, the children are changing at that age. So they're going to have these questions about identity, about, you know, what their preferences are, whether it's their first experience, maybe a feeling, you know, a certain way when it comes to the opposite sex or themselves. So I think it's really normal to let them explore and to be there in a non-judgmental way. And often, you know, the whole Tavistock Square thing was a big deal because we were referring as GPs to that. And it always didn't really sit well with me because, you know, parents would come in and say, my 8-year-old needs to go to Tavistock Square, and we would have a lot of criteria to run through and talk about. And I often would say, that's fine that they're expressing that. Sit with it, you know, have those conversations, let it be. If it's 5-6 years down the line and they're still feeling this certain way or whatever it might be, then we can think about what to do. But I think to immediately jump on it is probably not the right thing to do. And I don't think encouraging or discouraging is right either. It's just accepting. It's just being inclusive. And like you said, Georgie, it's actually, I think the current teenagers and the current sort of, you know, generation are very accepting.
Yeah.
In fact, my niece will be telling me
in a really admirable way. Yeah,
and they'll tell you that's normal. You know, my niece is saying to my mum, so their grandmother, that's completely normal. Yeah. Nana, that's what happens now.
And actually, it leads into the fact that you know, truly, we're in an era where you can be whoever you want to be, and that is wonderful. The freedom for that is liberating for that generation. It comes with a lot of challenges. But also a lot of liberation, which is great. Can we end on family and the importance of family dynamics and what an important role? And we touched on it slightly earlier with the boundaries and having somewhere to come home to where you feel safe. But what advice do you have for parents striking a balance, raising independent children, you know, providing a loving home? And I remember going to a talk at my children's school that said, this is many years ago, said children need a strong work ethic, resilience, and to know that they're loved. And it always stayed with me. I thought it was really powerful. What would you add, Dr. Raj, about the importance of the family unit?
I love that. I think for me, obviously having my own family unit and having a second one soon, I think nurturing, not raising, is important. So you're not going to dictate what your values, and that's quite hard not to do, I think, sometimes. Deflect those. Everything you were not and everything you were does not need to be what your child is going to be. And that's been quite hard for me.
Yes, it's quite awakening when you think your child is going, you think you're going to put your own or husband's genes together and it will produce
the
best of both of you.
And then you're like, what? Are you mine?
So you have an expectation and you want your child to become that expectation. That's hard not to do, but that's important. So you're nurturing a child. And I think what you said there is complete. I say this all the time. Resilience is key. We all talk about openness, discussion, encouraging, not judgmenting. But we also want there to be a resilience to cope with life, because life isn't easy, you know. And if we're just going to keep saying, it's okay, I'm here.
I always say, I can't fix everything. I wish I could.
And they've got to find their own way. And I think resilience is something that you can't give to somebody. They've got to go through life's experiences and learn how to be resilient from that. And I think if you're allowing them to make those good choices, the bad choices, and just being there for them, they're going to get a level of resilience. They're going to have their own mindset. So I think nurture, resilience, love, and some boundaries are important. That's what I would say.
And some hard work.
Good work ethic.
They've got to know it's not all on a plate.
No,
100%.
You have to graft. Yeah. And we know, research shows from many, many years back, the resilience comes from a good attachment to your attachment figure. So it is nurturing. So when you do nurture and the child feels that they are loved and they're supported, they do have resilience. That's just the way it is. If you're not loved and you don't feel attached to your parent and you don't have resilience, no matter how much you throw them out into the world and say, go off and do your best, they can't, because they don't have that core.
The grounding.
The grounding. I was just,
It's like what I said earlier about you go away for 10 years and then you're 30, like 30, 35, and then you go back to your parent because you have a nurturing bond. So
It's lovely.
So you go back and say, Mummy, this is now annoying me. And then you get more resilient because you've had a conversation. Yeah. So it's that whole to and fro for the rest of your life.
Yeah. Georgina.
I actually read a quote from Michelle Obama, who has a book came out last year, and it was to do with kind of lessons from her parents. And she had said that her mother said to her, "I'm not raising children, I'm raising adults." And it's just really stayed with me, particularly these teenage years, that and I feel like that encapsulates certainly the resilience, the work ethic. But I want, you know, that's what you want to see.
Wonderful, walking out the door. Happy adults.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because you can make a child happy. Give them some sweets. But, you know, it's harder to make a young adult happy.
Yeah. Words of wisdom from you all. Thank you so much, ladies. I feel like we could go on and on and on. Anyway, you can find out more about the Soak Clinic and the Face Bible in the notes below. Thank you so much, ladies.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you for joining me. That's it for today. If you enjoyed that, found that useful, then do please tell your friends to listen to, and we will be back soon. Thanks very much. Bye-bye.